Welcome to Extreme Genes, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And you have found America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. My name is Fisher. I am your radio root sleuth on the program where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Great guests coming up today. As always, in about 8 minutes, we're going to be talking to Becky Perrigo. She's a Pennsylvania woman. And her great-grandfather's brother went missing, I mean, decades ago, almost a century ago. And then she gets an email one day from somebody who says, hey, we found the remains of your great-great-uncle, and you won't believe where they were and what has happened since. It's an incredible story. You're going to want to catch this coming up a little bit later on in the show. After that, Paul Woodbury is back. He's from LegacyTree.com, and he's literally back from a genealogy road trip to Europe, and he's going to give you some great tips about how to plan your trip. What went right with his trip? What went wrong with it? How can you make your plans? There's a lot to this, and it's great advice coming up later in the show. But right now, my good friend David Allen Lambert is on the line from the New England Historic Genealogical Society and AmericanAncestors.org. He is the chief genealogist. How are things in Beantown, David?
Oh, it's doing very well. And I hope that some of our listeners get the newsletter now and enjoying the top 10 tips that I supplied for them to check out.
Yeah, absolutely. The Weekly Genie is now available. You can sign up. It's free. And you get all kinds of links to great stories. And you can learn more about your favorite Extreme Genes personalities. And you can sign up right there at ExtremeGenes.com or on our Facebook page. And speaking of Facebook, by the way, David, the other day I found a newspaper article that had been digitized, and I've posted it on Facebook, and it's just incredible. This minister back in the 1890s was going to a funeral for this woman, and he enters the room with the coffin and the lady, and the family is very excited. Here's the quote. They said the woman's left hand was moving.
Oh, my.
The minister found the woman was not dead, but apparently in a trance. And taking her from the coffin, he applied restoratives, and in an hour, Mrs. Westerhaus opened her eyes. She is now in good health, and she narrowly escaped being buried alive.
Ooh, that's kind of scary. Oh, unfortunately, yeah. They have found archaeological evidence of caskets that inside on the coffin are scratch marks.
Oh, the worst thing ever. Unbelievable. So what do you have for us today for our family histoire news?
You know, you may be still looking for great-great-grandpa. Have you ever tried the Smithsonian Institute?
Huh?
Yeah. The Smithsonian has in their collection 17,000 human remains.
I did not know that. That's crazy.
Yeah, and it's kind of scary, including one of them. It was a recent donation from the family. It's not that somebody recently died. Back in 1866, on an expedition to Alaska, Robert Kennicott, a Smithsonian scientist, died. They thought he died from suicide, but now, after unearthing him, he was buried in a lead casket, so a lot of preservation was present. They've discovered that he had gold and mercury fillings that may have been the cause of why he died.
Huh.
So the family signed over the remains. He's now in acquisition. I don't know the catalog number, but there he is at the Smithsonian, probably behind a locked door. You can't go and visit him, but there's a great article that showed up recently in the Washington Post. Going across the pond in the spring, I had a chance to go back to London. I had a wonderful time. I took lots of pictures. But for the ones I didn't take, and the ones shy of having a time machine, there's a great new website. Remember the New York site we talked about last year?
With the map and all the photographs. You could click on a little area in a particular block and see old photos of that space back in the day.
Well, the Brits have got it now going for London. They have over 250,000 images from the 15th century, from engravings and drawings, all the way down to now. You can pinpoint on a map, zoom in, and there are so many images to choose from. You have to think which one you really want.
It would take you weeks, I think, to go through this thing. We were looking at it before the show, and it's incredible.
It really is, and it just goes to show you technology and archives can work together with mapping. Zoom right in on a satellite view and look at what it was like before the Blitz or maybe in the 1700s from a drawing. So I think it's great, especially if you're looking for your ancestors' church.
Yeah, that would be absolutely perfect. Now, where do they find this?
This is going to be just an easy search, searching for London Picture Map, and that is through the City of London website. I'll put it on my Twitter feed, DL Genealogist, as well as extremegenes.com and our Facebook page.
Excellent. All right, what else do you have, David?
Heading to the other part of the world, I want to say shout out to those in the Rio Summer Games. But for us genealogists and those that are doing one-name studies, why not look back at the previous athletes going back to the Games in Athens in 1896 with a database that's available from www.olympic.org/athletes. You can search on anybody who participated in the games in the last 120 years.
That's incredible. In fact, I was looking on there for a friend of mine who was on a water volleyball team back in 1960, and there he was.
It's really fun when you can actually find relatives or maybe old schoolmates. I want to do a shout out this week to my sister-in-law, Kelly Sonner, out in Surprise, Arizona, and her new kindergartner, Audrey, my niece, who is actually the reason for this week's tech tip. Audrey has wonderful art that she created through preschool, and what her mom has done is photograph and create photo collage books and saved lots of space, and you may find that you want to save all your kids' art and drawings. She sampled it and has made up volumes year by year, and this is what she'll continue through grade school. A great tech tip, and thanks, and hello to Kelly and Audrey. That's all I have for this week, and catch you later, Fish.
All right, David, great stuff as always, and we will catch up with you next weekend.
Talk to you soon.
And this segment of Extreme Genes has been brought to you by RootsMagic.com. And coming up for you next, we're going to talk to a Pennsylvania woman whose great-grandfather's brother disappeared almost a century ago. Family had no idea where he was. Now they found him. And you're going to want to hear what has happened to those remains. It's a great story with Becky Perrigo from Pennsylvania coming up next on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, your Radio Roots sleuth. And I'm sure most of us over the course of our lifetimes have had the opportunity to watch the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. I think it came out like around 1975. Jack Nicholson, of course, the star. And it was filmed in Salem, Oregon, at the Oregon State Hospital, which over the years has developed, frankly, a horrendous reputation for problems over the decades. And among those things happens to be a repository that was discovered not that long ago of the cremains of many people whose families never came to claim the remains of their loved ones. And among the families that have been affected by this is the family of my next guest. Her name is Becky Perrigo. She is in Boswell, Pennsylvania. Becky, welcome to Extreme Genes. Nice to have you.
Thanks for having me.
This is quite the story, and I know that it actually is one that found you, as it worked out. Tell us a little about the background. This is an uncle of yours, a great uncle or something from a ways back. Fill us in on how this came to your doorstep.
Well, I always knew growing up that my father's grandfather had a brother who had disappeared. My dad had looked into it. This was prior to the internet, so, you know, he just hit dead ends. He knew he moved somewhere out west, maybe Washington or Oregon, and then was never heard from again. And my dad just kind of gave up on that. So I was on Ancestry.com one day. I had logged into my account, and I noticed I had an email from a woman named Phyllis Sagers, and she's from Oregon. And she was letting me know that my great-grandfather's brother was one of the people who died at Oregon State Hospital, whose cremains were never retrieved or claimed by the family. And I'm reading this and I'm thinking, you know, this kind of sounds familiar.
Yeah.
And then I'm thinking, this is a scam. This lady's going to demand money from me and I'm going to be out $500. But I Googled it and I came up, the first thing I found was the Oregon State Hospital website, and they had a searchable database of names. So I typed in Garrison and there he was. And it was, like I said, my great-grandfather's brother. And it was just, it was an amazing thing. I called my dad all excited. I was trembling. You know, I got on Facebook, the nerd that I am, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you guys aren't going to believe this. And I actually had so many friends that were like, this is amazing.
It is.
And it was something that made national news and actually changed laws. Just the fact that they had a database on their website a handful of years ago wouldn't have happened because of HIPAA laws and things like that.
Right.
So, you know, Senator Peter Courtney in Oregon helped change those laws just so they could get the names out there to find people. But even with that, Phyllis that reached out to me, they don't have anyone employed that are trying to find the relations of these people. And Phyllis, just on her own in her spare time, started checking into people and seeing if she could find family members. It was something that touched her heart, and that's how she reached out to me.
And she's reached several hundred people so far, as I understand it, out of like a thousand something or something around 400?
Yes. She's researched, as of a year ago, she's researched over 1,000 people, reached out to 400, and about 100 had gotten back to her to see about how they could go forward in claiming the cremains of their relatives.
Now, tell us a little about your ancestor or your relative, Thomas Espy Gerritsen. Born around 1883, died 1941. What was he doing in the Northwest, you know? Because he was from Pennsylvania originally, as you are.
He was. He was born in Bedford County and moved to Johnstown, Pennsylvania, right after the big Johnstown flood of 1889. He was one of seven brothers, and the oldest brother, Nathan, owned a tin shop. And I think what made him move out there was the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Ohio and was working at Goodrich at the rubber mill, and he was a fire builder, which, you know, Johnstown, Pennsylvania, we're a big steel, at one time we were a big steel town. I think he was just trying to move to where the work was. And we actually did find some newspapers.com articles where he was trying to hire workers out in Oregon. But at this point, I think that mentally he was deteriorating a little bit. Like, he thought he was an inventor and all these things. And I think he was running these ads looking for workers, but I don't think he had 2 cents to rub together.
Mm.
You know, we believe that's how he ended up out there, because all of the Gerritsens pretty much stayed in this area, except for him and one brother. The other brother had moved to Ohio as well.
So what was he diagnosed with in the hospital at the time? Do you recall?
That was one of the nice things. We did get his medical files. He was a manic depressive. He was a heavy drinker, and he had some auditory hallucinations. He was having commands from God, and he had kind of elevated himself, and he talked even... They would have little quotes from him in his medical files, and he talked about how he was going to be like Thomas Edison. But I think pretty much what it was manic depression and alcoholism.
Hmm.
And those are two things now that, you know, we've got AA these days. And if you're a manic depressive, you take a little pill in the morning and you're as functional as anyone else.
Yeah, that's often the case, no question. And how long was he in the hospital?
Well, he was admitted. We actually found out he was admitted twice. He was admitted in 1924 for the first time for about 7-8 months. And then the second time, he went back in 1925. And he was there from 1925 to 1941 when he died there.
Now, do you think as a tin worker that he was actually involved in creating these little tin canisters for all the cremains of the people who were there?
I do. And that was kind of me investigating a little bit. I started researching OSH and the things they did there, and they had work farms. And a lot of these people helped out with different things. I believe their bedding, different things that they used there, was all made on site. And doing the research, I started Googling as to whether or not these urns were made there, and they were.
Incredible.
I really feel, because of his background as a tinsmith, coppersmith, that he may have made his own urn. So that's a little bit of, you know, irony there, but I think it makes it neater for us that he may have made that.
Yes. Now, you went back there to actually tour the facility and to find his remains, the place that he's at. He's part of a wall of honor, basically, that they've created for these people, yes?
Yes. What they did is, once they found all these copper urns, and they decided, you know, they needed to do more than stick them in a garden shed, they took the cremains out of them. They put them in new little urns, and they slip into a wall. And then in the wall, they have circles, like plates with the numbers on them. So he was number 2696. So in the wall, it had his name and his number and his date of birth and death. And then they took the copper urns and they put those, I think at one time it was like a garage or a carriage house. They took one wall of it out, encased it in glass, and then they had all of these copper urns. I mean, all you saw was
Wow.
patina on these. It was beautiful. And then when you see that an urn is gone, you know, that's a happy ending. That family came and claimed their people and took them home. So I got to see it when he was a part of it. And then a few months later, we got his ashes and his urn. So now he will have, you know, there's no urn there. We know that he's a good ending to the story.
Where did you have him buried?
Well, he is still actually sitting in my parents' living room. But I know, we're procrastinators. We got him. We wanted to order a stone. We wanted to do everything the right way. And right now it's just kind of been teaming up. I have a cousin who's a minister who's going to perform a service for him. And it's just kind of been waiting to see when everyone can get together and then something new pops up. And it doesn't happen. But he's going to be buried with his mother. We contacted the cemetery in Bedford County where she is buried. And it's not a problem for us to bury his ashes with her. And then we'll have a flat memorial headstone that will go there as well. Because he was only 4 years old when his mother died. By age four, Thomas was an orphan.
Wow.
So
buried with mom.
Buried with mom. His parents were separated when they died. They died a few months apart, and there was a snowstorm. And here in southwestern Pennsylvania, you know, that just shuts everything down if we get a big snow.
Sure.
So, you know, his dad's buried at one cemetery with a lot of the family, but then his mother, we just felt that she needed her baby with her. You know, that was her little boy, and he needed to be with his mom. And I think maybe some of his issues had to do with losing both parents at such a young age and bouncing
sure.
around and living with different people in orphanages.
Yeah, so, it had to be very challenging.
Absolutely.
And one kind of exclamation point on this whole story is that currently Phyllis found a family of a Civil War veteran who is now making the trek back to the Northeast on a motorcycle, which is incredible to me to think that that would be the case. And he's going to be buried with his family as well.
Yes, Jewett Williams. I read the article online recently, and even Jewett's story is really amazing because he was part of the 20th Maine. And now he wasn't at Little Round Top, I think, from what I saw. He enlisted after that. But, you know, Colonel Chamberlain, like, that's just a huge story. So that's a really famous group to be involved with.
And Phyllis is doing just such incredible work to make all this happen. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time, Becky, but thank you so much for your time and sharing your story with us. What a nice ending to a very difficult life.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
And coming up next, we'll talk to Paul Woodbury about his recent research trip to Europe. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, and here we are in the dead of summer, and a lot of people are traveling, doing research trips this summer, diving into their family history and going all over the place, rural areas and urban areas, across oceans. And if you're planning on doing something like this anytime soon, it's really important to be prepared. And that's where my next guest comes in, Paul Woodbury from LegacyTree.com. And Paul, welcome back to the show. Good to have you. You've been on the road.
Yes, I have been. It's been a wonderful summer. I just got back from Scotland and France.
Wonderful. You don't have an accent. I usually pick those up anywhere I go. I'll come back from Scotland talking like this. I don't know why that is. It takes me a week or two to readjust. I guess I like to adapt to where I am, right? But, boy, preparing to go on a trip to Europe is particularly difficult, I think, because you can't just pick up the phone and make certain arrangements. But at the end of the day, the bottom line is always this, that your time is even more important than your money when you're going on these trips, because you've got to accomplish a lot in a little bit of time. Tell us some of your tips of what you did to make this trip work for you.
Well, so in my experience preparing for research trips, particularly to Europe, I think one of the most important elements is to make sure that you do as much research as you can in the United States with the records that are available in the United States.
Yes.
So that you're really making the most of your time there, focusing in record collections that aren't easily available elsewhere. When I was in high school, I prepared a research trip with my family, and I didn't really know what I was doing, and I said, hey, you know, let's go to these small towns in Denmark and Sweden where my ancestors came from, and we can go to the churches and talk to the people and see if we can find more information. So it was a little bit discouraging when we got there, and we went and visited these churches and said, hey, do you have any information on genealogy, and they said, oh yeah, you know, the Mormons came in a few years ago and filmed it all, and it's all available in Salt Lake City. And it was, I mean, you know, we got all the way over to Denmark to do our family history research, and they said, oh yeah, it's all in Salt Lake. So really make sure that you know what record collections are available on site versus in the United States so that you can prioritize what you're really looking at as you go there.
Boy, that is absolutely some of the best advice ever. You're absolutely right. And that's the thing. Sometimes you can't help it, though. I've had that experience where I've done all the research I thought I could accomplish here, went over there, did some work, and then came back here and found some of the things that I wish I'd found before I'd left.
Yes.
I mean, it just happens that way sometimes.
It does happen that way sometimes. But, I mean, that is part of the research process where, you know, as you discover things on site, that's going to inform your decisions as you come back and are working with some of the records later on that you have at your fingertips.
Well, and you know, when you go to places like France, now you're dealing with language barriers as well, potentially. And that's why it's so important your communication before you leave is absolutely essential.
Yeah. When we went to France, something that I did is I made a huge research list. I was lucky because my wife came along with, and then also my mother-in-law and my two sisters-in-law. So we did a little bit of tourism, but the requirement for them to be able to come was that they had to be my assistants and help me film documents and look through things. So that was nice to have all of that help. So we made a huge list of all of the documents that we particularly wanted to look through for specific surnames. I think it's important to identify your goals beforehand so you're not getting there and saying, okay, well, what do I want to look at today?
Right.
Really have a detailed research plan. And if you're going to be having other people help you with that, to make sure that you have clearly identified the surnames or the individuals that you want them to be looking for. One of the challenges that we ran into was that my wife and her family don't speak French. But I was able to make a list of all the surnames and identify some keywords and some keyword lists of things that they could begin to recognize, okay, this is the surname and this is the town. And so these are the types of things that we're looking for.
Well, and one of the things that I've noticed, too, when you go on these trips is you have to make a list of the times that these places are open. Because often, you know, certain people are on certain days and certain times and others aren't. And so if you're making the full list, you can actually start to map out, okay, on this day, I'm going to go to this area. Maybe you're going west of where your headquarters is. On another day, you might be going east of where your headquarters is. And sometimes you have to wrap these things around what the schedules are of the various archives or facilities that you're going to go visit. And that can save you a heck of a lot of time and a lot of frustration, too. Nothing worse than getting there, crossing the pond, and getting to a place and finding, oh, I've traveled a day or whatever from where I'm at and I can't get in?
Yeah, and it's particularly important to check with the archives regarding their summer schedules. A lot of people, particularly during the months of July and August, a lot of Europe is on vacation, including the archives. So make sure that you are checking the times and being aware of the archive websites, being in contact with those individuals to say, hey, is the archive going to be open? One of the archives we visited during this trip is currently under construction, and so I was worried for the first few months before we were headed out. I kept emailing them and saying, are you going to be open when we're there? We're coming to visit you. So luckily, none of the construction interfered with the documents that we were able to find there.
Did you find it easy to email with people, especially in France, because of the language situation, or were you actually writing them in French?
I was writing them in French, and I speak French, I know French, and so that did help a lot.
And did they respond well to Americans? I mean, you hear the reputation in some places.
You know, if you go and start trying to speak English, a lot of the times they'll assume you're from England. And so when they find out you're American, they're much nicer.
Really?
At least that's what we discovered as we were there.
It always seems on any trip that I take like that, I've been over to England myself, especially to do some research, that right at the end somewhere, there's always somebody who says, oh, by the way, have you looked into this stash? And I had that happen at the very end of one trip and wound up finding some amazing things, a book that my ancestor in the 1700s had signed that had to do with a group of merchants actually creating their own little insurance company for their own burials when they died. And so it was a very interesting thing to look at and see some of the names that were signed and who they were grouped with, because you can assume there's associations there on those kinds of lists, you know?
Yeah. And a previous trip while I was in the archive, I was researching a specific family, and I mentioned the name of the family I was researching to the archivist. And she didn't know anything about it, but another researcher overheard our conversation and pointed me in the direction of a journal article that was written by a local history professor on my fifth great-grandfather and his times and his social history. They mentioned his house, and because of that, I was able to get in contact with a local priest in the area who then invited me to come stay at the monastery with him, and then we went out and visited the house of my fifth great-grandfather, which is still standing.
You stayed in a monastery?
Yeah.
Wow, how cool is that?
It was really cool. And what was really neat about this experience was that this particular ancestor, in his free time, would engrave in stone. And he decorated the walls of his home with these engravings, which were proverbs, hymns to the French nation. And most important to me was a stone that documented his genealogy back five generations. That was just sitting there on the walls of his house.
So no.
That was pretty amazing.
Did you get pictures of that?
Oh, yes, I did.
And are these names that were not available in other records?
They were names that were available in other records, but this stone actually proved an alternate genealogy than what we had for that individual previously.
Validated,
so
it. Unbelievable.
To really clarify what his family history actually was.
Boy, and on that note, we say thank you, Paul Woodbury. Great to chat with you. And preparation, very important part of any trip. Make those calls, prepare ahead of time, and check in with people. They're going to help you out.
Yep.
Thanks so much, Paul.
Thank you.
And coming up next, it's our Preservation Authority, Tom Perry. How are you, Tom?
Excellent.
And I guess the best way to title what we're going to talk about today is this. Hey, congratulations. You've digitized all your stuff. Now what?
Exactly.
Right? I mean, because there are a lot of options of things to do, and I'm in the middle of this right now.
Oh, exactly. In fact, you're a good source for information on what you're doing right now. What's really interesting is a lot of people, as we tell them on the show, get the stuff digitized. Once that's done, you can do whatever you want to do later.
You can take your time.
Yeah, exactly. No big deal. It's digitized. It's stored. You know, I can get to it. Now, there's some people that are so excited, like yourself, that have taken that step that now want to find out, what do I do now? And like we've talked about in shows in the past, you always want to kind of do this on a backwards type thing. You want to go into the future and decide what you want to do. If you want to make YouTube videos, if you want to be able to distribute this to all your family, if you want to have this just for your own kids, there's so many different ways. So you have to figure out what you want in the end and then start working towards what we're doing now. So we need to see what the end goal is. If you want to distribute it and do a lot of fun things, there's a lot of cool things we've talked about, like the DaVinci, which is a great program, and you can download a basic version of it absolutely for free, which you have done.
Yes.
And it's totally free. If you get into it and really find out, wow, I love this video editing, I want to go full bore on this, then you can buy the other one and knock out some pretty incredible things. You can add photos, you can add audio. It's really nice to use.
And the metadata.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Very important.
That is. In fact, that brings up a really interesting thing, too. Another software that we highly recommend is called Heritage Collectors. It does all kinds of metadata like you're talking about. So you're looking at these photos 20 years from now, you'll know exactly what the GPS coordinates are, where they were shot, different things, if they're aerial views. You can do all kinds of cool things with them. They even have the software that you can go in and physically make a calendar, but you make up the file that you then take to a Kinko's or FedEx store or something like that, or put it on your home computer, and it will have like little QR codes built right into it. So on grandma and grandpa's birthday, they can scan it with their smartphone, and it'll be the family wishing them happy birthday and singing happy birthday to them. You can go in and take things from the past, like old audio recordings, and on grandpa's birthday, who is now passed, with these metadatas, with the QR codes, all these kind of things make it so fun and interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing the technology that's available right now. But at the end of the day, you're right. You've got to decide a couple of things. First of all, how much time do you have to devote to the project?
Correct.
I think you need to know that even before you figure out your end goal, because that can affect it. I mean, if you've got 50 years to work on it, you know, you might have a different approach than if you had 5 to 10 years to work on it, you know, in terms of life expectancy and your interest. And then the question is who in the family or who in the general public is going to want to access this, or do you want to give access to? And then you have to narrow it down and say, what am I capable of doing? Am I capable of paying somebody
to do some of the things that I'd like to have done? Or is there somebody in the family who can help us out? So you got to sort a lot of things out before you can determine maybe what your next step is and what you can actually use as tools to get you there. There's really a lot of factors involved in determining what you do with your materials once you've already had them digitized. And that can include your age, your technical capabilities, your financial status, how many years you may have left to live, who your audience is. I mean, there are a lot of things. So let's get into a little of this, Tom, and talk about different tools that may be involved depending on what direction you want to go.
Exactly. And that's really good. And at the end of the segment, we talked about a race. If you look at a race, there's all different kinds of races. So if you want just a sprint, you just want to get something to your kids really quick, find out how you want to distribute it. So it's easy for the kids just to get it down and dirty and quick, and they can do what they want to do. The relay race, which you kind of talked about, is, hey, I'm 75 years old. I've got 40 different tapes I need to edit. It's not going to happen in my lifetime. Let me go and write down what I have here, give a good description, get started on it, do what I can, then hand it down to my kids, and then they can pick it up. Because some of these people that are working on projects have been handed down from generation to generation.
Sure.
They're adding more photos as they become available. And people that are doing family research, they find out that there's, you know, weird things in their family history. And that's a new piece that now needs to be edited to their family history. Videos, films, scrapbooks, all these different kinds of things.
And I would imagine people who, say, are in the peak of their careers don't have the time to deal with this, even if they have the technical ability to do a lot of the editing.
Exactly.
And so that's the point where you say, well, can I turn this over to somebody like you or some local distributor or some local editor who can actually do the work for you? And that in itself is probably the simplest thing, but it's also the most expensive way.
It is, absolutely. You know, we have to pay our employees, so it can be kind of expensive. One thing you can do, you can go to your local high schools, you can go to your local junior colleges, regular colleges, and a lot of times if they have kind of a media program, they might, you know, take on a project as a freebie almost, just to help their students get some real-world experience.
Right.
And so you give them your stuff, and they can go in and edit it, kind of draw an outline of what you want. The tools they have now with smartphones and with, you know, Macs and PCs and all these different kinds of computers that used to cost $10,000, $20,000. Now you can get a system for $1,000, and a lot of schools will let the kids use the school computers to do projects like this. So especially if you're in an area where you don't really have the time and you don't have the money to pay somebody else to do it, go and look at local resources. Check out your junior colleges or even your elementary school.
Yeah, somebody might be willing to help you with that and get it done. And that's so important. And then once you're done with that, you can post it to where it needs to go or send copies to where it needs to go. Let's talk. We've only got about 45 seconds here, Tom. A few tools that might be of use in different types of projects.
One thing I tell people to check out is if you're a PC user, get PowerDirector. It's a great program. It's only $50. It's rated really, really high. We've already talked about DaVinci is a great program. We talked about Heritage Collectors is great software.
Yes.
People used to use Cinematize, which I love, and there's a few copies still out there. The one that's really replaced it is Wondershare.
Tom, good to see you. Thanks for coming on. We'll see you next week.
Sounds good.
Hey, that wraps up our show for this week. We'll be back next week with more expert guests, so we hope you'll join us then. Talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family. This has been Extreme Genes. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.